quick before the podcast starts. Take 90 seconds to help pay for it. Public Media is funded by the public. Contribute at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's an exploration of how people with autism view the world. Marty Murphy says her life is very different from neurostandard people.
I don't make small talk well, and I'm expected to, I guess. And I don't really understand why. Life is just a social nightmare, really.
Charlie Schlenker talks with Murphy and Chuck Hartzell of Autism McLean. Laura Kennedy profiles a Bloomington Normal mandolin group. Orpheus Mandolin Orchestra plays the Normal Theater this weekend. And John Norton talks with Bloomington Normal-grown blues musician Matthew Curry about life on the road. He's been touring off and on for the last 4 years. His next stop is at the Castle Theater Saturday night. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's April 27th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A lot has happened in the last 2 years to make Bloomington Normal friendlier to people with autism. In that time, the group Autism McLean has worked with the JCs and Mark First to develop an inclusive playground at Harmony Park and created new spaces for people on the spectrum to gather. They've also worked to educate community groups and businesses about how workers who have autism can be good employees, and have worked with libraries to expand programming for people on the spectrum. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Marty Murphy and Chuck Hartzell about other efforts.
Another initiative that we've just recently started is one called Sensory Bags, which are bags that businesses can have that will provide different items for an individual with autism to help them relax within that environment or to have a better experience there so that they're not anxious over loud noises or things of that nature.
So what goes into those bags?
We have headphones. We have the
Dark glasses.
Dark glasses. We have fidget toys. We have teething things that they can chew on to help relax them. You have signage in there for getting them to calm down or to explain things to them if they're nonverbal.
Have the efforts of the group resulted in more employment for people with autism?
It's opening up more opportunities. I don't honestly know if there's been an upswing in employment for those individuals, but businesses are much more willing to look at accommodations and modifications, and we've talked with a couple of different businesses about some alternative activities that they can do, and at least two or three more individuals have been employed, but whether it's due to that or just they have the opportunity, I couldn't tell you.
What is your two-year plan looking forward? What do you want to do?
One, we want to continue to raise awareness within the community. Two, we want to make sure that individuals with autism can feel more relaxed in going into businesses and things of that nature. We're looking again to network with other organizations in the area that are providing services to help them better respond to individuals with autism and continue to approach businesses in regard to employment opportunities.
For people out there who may not really have been aware of people on the spectrum before, what are some of the things that you're teaching businesses and teaching staff so that people know that it may be a non-standard neuro response?
Focusing on the abilities that they might bring to a position and or to a company, which is an opportunity for them to be in attendance, follow routine. When given directions, they will carry those out to the letter. so that we're accentuating the positive aspects of what can happen. The issues that they might run into are interpersonal relations within a business, how to respond to a coworker, limiting the conversation, being able to talk about other things than just what they as an individual want to talk about. And so more of the social skill development in regard to what it takes to interact within a business setting, what to do when you're done with a task and where to go to find what I do next if they need that kind of support and guidance. At the university levels and the community college levels, we're working on how individuals can better accommodate themselves within those environments. If they need assistance somewhere, they know how to ask for that assistance. When they're out with friends, how do I interact with them? What kinds of things are necessary for me to have a relationship with someone that's positive?
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With us are Chuck Hartzell and Marty Murphy from Autism McLean. Marty, from the perspective of someone on the spectrum, what can you tell neurostandard people about how you tick, about what they can expect from you?
You know, they can expect that I'll do my best as I work, that I listen to what they say. A lot of times an employer will say what they and they think you understand all of it. It may be, would you like to move those chairs over there? Well, you know, there's 10 rows and you pointed there. And there's a separation in the chairs, so I've only moved these. So in your opinion, I haven't done the full job. But in my opinion, I moved the chairs you asked me to move. So it's knowing that I need all of that information. It's the social aspect of it. My social skills are not very good at all. But the Autism McLean, there's a summer camp that they run that works with, it's called I Am Social Camp. So our social skills improve. We have everybody from 18-year-olds to, you know, 55-year-olds in this camp. And it's just learning to interact well with each other. But they could expect me to be a very loyal employee until, you know, they're disloyal to me, and then I'm just kind of done, you know, when I feel betrayed, I guess.
What are some of the social cues and social situations that you've had to learn consciously that neurostandard people just sort of have going on in the background that they don't really realize?
I don't make small talk well, and I'm expected to, I guess, and I don't really understand why I'm expected to make small talk. I mean, if this is making sense as an answer to your question, to me, you're not conveying anything. Your small talk is pointless. I would rather sit in silence, and trying to show interest in someone else that I don't even know half the time. How to approach a guy for directions, just cold, just, you know, excuse me. And I think I sometimes come across a little unusual that way. I've got some friends that are moving away, and that's the whole social thing that's very difficult for me to work through right now. When I think other people just, hey, you know, people move away, it happens. But I've gotten very attached. So society, life is just a social nightmare, really.
Not easy. So one of the parts of Autism McLean is the social cafe at the Normal Public Library. How does that address your needs, and what is it intended to do for other people on the spectrum in all the variety of the spectrum? Because it's not just autism is not a standard one thing all the time.
Right.
Many people have different places on the spectrum.
Right. We have very different people. There's a couple of people like I am, very high functioning, that at first blush you might not realize that we have a diagnosis of autism. And then a little bit later you kind of go, oh, well, there might be something wrong. And then there are a few that they walk in and you're like, oh, yeah. So you have this big spectrum. And yet we sit and we'll play games, we'll watch a movie, and then we'll talk about it. And some of the thoughts about a movie from some of the people who I would consider to be a little more impacted are actually really good. And making small talk with people of various, you know, because sometimes it's just sit and talk. Well, you know, 10 people don't just, I mean, we try to sit in silence, but there'll be someone usually there who will kind of coordinate what we're doing or talking about, or playing apples to apples and maybe modifying the rules a little bit. I signed, so I was there one day, and these two girls, and as we played a game, I can't remember what game we were playing, I caught them signing to each other, and I'm like, hey, you guys are cheating. And she said, oh, you're the one that signs. And it was like, yeah. But then, Jack's wife, Jackie, said, well, maybe you should have just let them do it. And I was like, well, no, cheating's wrong. Well, it's just a game, Marty, you know. And so I can make a little thing into a great big thing. Like my mountains or molehills, or my molehills, I make mountains, and then sometimes I don't react at all to something, you know, like I should. It's like, okay, that just happened.
Neurostandard people, so-called ordinary people, what do they need to know about personhood of people on the spectrum? That you may have different needs and different reactions, but you're still an emotionally fully formed person. How are they to apprehend that part of you?
Yeah, I think that just comes from awareness. We seem unusual, but we're not violent. We may be unpredictable in something that we say, but we're just...
No, I would argue it's very predictable given the place you're coming from, but not everyone knows that.
Right. It would be predictable. He can predict my reactions, but a lot of people that don't know me would see a reaction and go, what is wrong with her? Mm-hmm. And I don't do a lot of socializing and a lot of interaction. Most of what I do is within the autism community or in my synagogue. And my rabbi is very conscious of autism. Her daughter works with autism, so... that's actually used to be a very negative experience, and now it's a very positive one. So, but I think as word kind of spreads and autism awareness kind of grows, people are becoming more aware of the diversity. And, you know, a 10-year-old boy having a meltdown in the middle of a store and a 30-year-old scratching their head going, not exactly sure how I'm supposed to do this task because my boss didn't tell me completely. You know, I wasn't given the complete instructions to do it, and I need A, B, C, D, E. And he just went up to B, and I'm supposed to kind of clue in to E all by myself, and I might not be able to do that. I can do E, I can do A to E, but I have to know that I'm supposed to do those. So, you know, that's still an issue. But autism awareness is growing, but at the same time, it's also being used as an insult word. As it grows.
How so?
Well, I see online all the time, the word retarded has become, people now say intellectually challenged, unless you use it as an insult. And you see a lot of people on YouTube videos that are like, you know, well, welcome to Autismville when somebody does something unusual.
It's a way of othering.
I guess as awareness grows, so does...
The potential negatives, yeah.
The potential negatives, and I don't know how to get away with it.
By doing what we're doing right here.
Yeah.
Some people on the spectrum have difficulty in larger groups of people.
Oh, yeah.
They prefer small groups or even one-on-one encounters or
just
a
one,
a
just
group
yourself.
Of three. Yeah. And the energy required to interact in a social, in a larger group is huge, and they need a lot of decompression time afterwards. How does the social cafe operate within that sort of consideration, those needs?
At the Autism Cafe, you can actually go to another table. There's two women there at least. There usually is the guy that runs the library as well. So there's at least two, if not three or more, typical people that are there. So if you need to decompress during a conversation, and I had an incident at the Autism Cafe, and I just, you know, picked up my keys and left and went home. I wasn't even going to try. I returned, and then they had me sit over to the side to explain what the problem was, which I did. And other people will have...
So there is space.
They're not up in your face telling you, you know, you've got to move, or you've got to do this, or you've got to do that. And camp is the same way.
Chuck Hartzell and Marty Murphy of Autism McLean, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Autism McLean will hold a celebration tomorrow morning at 10:30 at Uptown Circle in Normal, recognizing different people and businesses in the community who have demonstrated an autism-friendly and welcoming atmosphere. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from the Central Illinois Regional Airport, providing worldwide access through daily nonstop service to Atlanta, Chicago, Dallas-Fort Worth, Minneapolis-St. Paul, and more. Flying out of Sierra keeps more money here in McLean County. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, Laura Kennedy profiles a local mandolin group performing in Bloomington Normal this weekend. The story and some music is on the way during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A MacArthur Genius Grant winner will perform this weekend in Bloomington Normal. Stephen Huff is the soloist with the Illinois Symphony Orchestra. He's a writer, poet, painter, and composer, as well as a virtuoso performer. It's rare that people show world-class expertise in more than one area. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with ISO music director Ken Lamb about how that can affect the art a person produces.
I think all art informs each other. Perhaps it's not just art. It's all aspects of life, I think, informs our art. And I think it's, whatever we do, our experiences, our, interaction with people, the world around us, whether it's just life or politics or whatever it is, I think it all goes into what we do as musicians. And because the notes are there, but there's always the saying that what's most important is what we have to say about those notes. And I think our own experiences and relationships with one another really informs that.
Let's talk about the piece. Brahms' first piano concerto came at a time when he was exposed to the mental deterioration of his friend Schumann. It came at a time when Mendelssohn had just died. What are the influences that go into making this?
Especially the opening of the D minor concerto, the just sort of very dark and angsty, and sort of describe that as maybe Brahms's reaction to the situation in Schumann's personal life, his struggles, and so on. I think this is the first major orchestra work of Brahms. It came even before the first serenade, and the symphonies came much later. the concerto actually started off as a sonata. It was then supposed to be a symphony. So Brahms was really searching for the right way to express these musical thoughts. He was also not a very experienced orchestrator at the time. You know, he was a pianist. He wrote a lot of piano music, but he was still, you know, really trying a lot of stuff. So what we hear, it's of course it's still a very mature work, but there's this youthfulness about it, which is really stunning.
Also, something to be said about musical partnerships and influences. And one of Brahms' great partnerships and inspirations was his friendship with the noted violin virtuoso Joseph Joachim. How does that figure into this piece?
Well, I think Joachim was very. I wasn't there. I mean, I'm just trying to remember. But wasn't there some 20 letters between the two of them? Joachim, with his experience, would be advising Brahms, and these letters were very long and thoughtful. And so there was always a great correspondence. Joachim was one of Brahms's first real sponsors, you know, and so was Schumann. You know, when this concerto was premiered, most places with the premiere was not favorable. But it, I think the only favorable review came from Schumann's own journal. So these of course, Joachim and Brahms is of course, most famously, is Brahms dedicated both his concertos for violin, you know, the double concerto and the violin to Joachim. And there's a very, very long friendship there.
Some works that initially hit the clunk go on to become these soaring monuments in the public mind for centuries afterwards, and why do some actually continue on to be fairly obscure until maybe 100 or so years later when they're revived and that people say, aha, then?
That it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you think of the music of even J.S. Bach, you know, which was when it was written, was really for the connoisseurs. You know, the musicians would know Bach's music, but not the general public. That's almost the million-dollar question of performers and composers in every age. You write what you want to express, but that may not cater for the popular taste. And a lot of music are ahead of its time. That's why these people are geniuses. But remember also, there are composers who, even within their lifetime, have found acceptance and fame. And those tend to be composers who didn't create new forms or break the sort of tradition. Now, Brahms is a great composer, but I think for most of his time, he utilizes the classical forms, and he just extended the language a little bit. But it was so, the craftsmanship is so perfect that I think even within his lifetime, people, you know, he achieved the fame and the acceptance in the general public. Thank you.
orchestra grown together in that time?
Well, I'd like to think that we've gotten to know each other a little bit, and I see a very wonderful group of people. And we hired a second clarinet, a second trombone, and I think four violins, earlier this year. So there are still a number of positions to fill. So in the coming months, we're looking to do that. And one of the things I'm doing also is, I'm having these sort of informal coffees and chats with the musicians, just to get a sense of, especially for those who have been in the orchestra for a while, to get their perspective on what they see as the next step where we should be heading, and just getting a little bit more, learning more and more about the history of this group, and it's, I think it's a nice chemistry right now. So hopefully we'll be able to do good things together.
Ken Lamb is the director of the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, performing Brahms' First Piano Concerto with soloist Stephen Huff at the BCPA Sunday at 3 p.m. You're listening to the finale of that concerto on GLT's Sound Ideas. Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Just over 100 years ago, mandolin mania swept the United States, inspiring people of all ages to pick up the instrument and even form their own amateur groups. Although musical tastes have changed and the guitar now commands center stage, a handful of mandolin groups are still making music with a distinctive instrument, including Central Illinois' own Orpheus Mandolin Orchestra. The group is holding its 10th annual spring soiree this weekend at the Normal Theater. Laura Kennedy has more.
Here we go. A 1, 2, 3, 4.
The Orpheus Mandolin Orchestra isn't just practicing. It's having a lesson from a master of the instrument. The group has an upcoming concert, and it's invited mandolinist Brian Oberlin to join them, as well as share a few pointers on the cheery and versatile instrument. The self-taught Oberlin is an internationally acclaimed mandolin player who performs almost exclusively as a soloist. He's a triple threat, adept at playing bluegrass, swing, and classical music. And of the three, Oberlin describes classical as uniquely demanding of mandolin players.
Primarily, it's the different right-hand techniques that you never hear in bluegrass or swing or pretty much any other music. Different right-hand techniques such as... stuff like that, Part of the classical music that I love is that it moves around. It's just not a normal piece of music that's 1-4-5, 1-4-5 chord progression. It has all these different movements and places to explore in the musical world.
When Oberlin takes the stage with the Orpheus Mandolin Orchestra, he'll be a part of a tradition that dates back to 1890. That's when the U.S. mandolin craze started. Martha Tyner plays with the Orpheus Mandolin Orchestra. She says the tradition of mandolin orchestras began in the old world, but quickly caught on in the States when a group from Spain, known as the Spanish Students, played a concert in New York to great acclaim. Other mandolin groups started up in the States, modeling calling themselves on the Spanish students.
In fact, one group called themselves the Spanish students, although they weren't from Spain and had nothing to do with it and were all Italian, but played that same kind of repertoire and started touring the country. So it was really the Italian organized ensembles that started spreading. Kind of that same turn of the 20th century era when glee clubs and a lot of universities had guitar and mandolin clubs. So it was an amateur, it started pretty much as an amateur community music making kind of thing.
Let me hear your mandolas. 2, 3, 4.
Jim Stanlaw plays the mandocello. It's bigger and is tuned a bit differently from the traditional mandolin. Stanlaw explains that the instrument came about as interest in mandolin groups was growing in the early 20th century. Gibson, makers of acoustic instruments, responded to that interest by creating instruments in varying sizes.
They were comparable to like a swing quartet, so you have mandolas, and there's even a mando bass and stuff, and that's really huge. They basically inundated the Midwest and actually the whole country with these teacher agents that would have like a truckload or a wagonload of mandolins of different sizes, and they go to every church, every group, every fraternity, every college campus, every glee club, and sell these instruments and then teach people how to play them. That's where the mandocello came from. It was the mandolin equivalent of the violoncello in a symphony orchestra.
Stanlaw is fascinated with the history of the mandolin orchestra. In fact, he's writing the notes for the program for the Sunday concert. Especially intriguing, he says, are the colorful characters who populated many orchestras in the 20s and 30s.
One guy was living on a houseboat, and he went by the name Captain. One guy was an astrologer, and he always put the name Tsar in front of his name, because he was Z-A-Y-R, because he was some kind of astrological title. So he was some grand poobah in astrology, and so there's a bunch of colorful characters in the history of the mandolin orchestra, these arrangers and stuff.
So what I'll do is I'll count it off. I'll go 1, 2, 3. Okay, so I have a pickup just by myself. I go 3.
As he continues to coach the Orpheus Mandolin Orchestra, Brian Oberlin works to keep the tradition of mandolin groups alive with every heartfelt tremolo.
It's a group of super dedicated people that just love it. And, we're kind of lucky. I mean, we're playing the greatest instrument in the world, the mandolin. So, you've got the tremolo and... So we're keeping traditions of music alive. The pure joy of it is what keeps people going.
The Orpheus Mandolin Orchestra is a relative newcomer on the mandolin ensemble scene. A scene that's not been terribly crowded these days, with about 30 to 35 in existence today. The Orpheus group actually started not long ago as an outgrowth of an old-time music jam happening in the Twin Cities. Musician Martha Tyner says one of the mandolin players wanted to branch out and explore classical music. Several other mandolin players joined him and began to explore the music together.
So we started kind of meeting an extra half hour before the jam, and about 4 more mandolin players showed up who weren't coming to the jam but were mandolin players. So it's just gone on from there. Eventually, we had to find our own night and go on through our own rehearsals because we got interested in doing it. We have music from string ensembles. We had some music from recorder ensembles. And we just started playing together because we liked it. And then to have a reason to practice, we decided we should make a program. And so that started the notion of the spring soiree, which is really just a goal for us to work towards, to have a program.
Originally, the ensemble dubbed themselves the McLean County Mandolin Society. Then an orchestra member, digging into some local history, made an interesting discovery.
One of the women who was playing with us then, Amy Miller, is a volunteer local historian. She just likes to look up history and things, and she came across this newspaper clipping announcing actually the wedding of Fred T. Ashton, well-known leader of the Orpheus Mandolin Orchestra in Bloomington. So we looked a little more and discovered that he had an ensemble. It was actually, we have their picture from the McLean County Museum of History, a newspaper ad. It was 2 mandolins and a bass and a guitar and a violin, I think, or something, a little variety. And I don't know how long they played, because Fred T. Ashton then went on to organize a bigger kind of dance band and later a fairly big kind of community band. He was like the music guy. He taught lessons and conducted all kinds of music. And then he moved out west somewhere and sold trees. He was the original Orpheus Mandolin Orchestra. So when we discovered that, we figured, well, we'd better be the revival of the original Orpheus Mandolin Orchestra, hence the name.
One of the reasons why mandolin ensembles endure, says Brian Oberlin, is the fact that the instrument itself is just so versatile.
You can play swing, bluegrass, classical, Irish music, polkas. You can play chords. You can play leads. You can play tremolo. Anything. And it fits in the overhead carry in a plane.
Jim Stanlaw agrees. He joined the Orpheus Mandolin Orchestra because he just fell in love with the instrument. Now he finds himself stricken with MAS, Mandolin Acquisition Syndrome.
It just kind of took over. Search for the cure. And so here was a chance to play another mandolin instrument from the mandolin family. And I said, yeah, okay. And it was an excuse to buy another instrument. So, you know, and hunt for one, which is always kind of fun. And so that's what kind of got me into it. It wasn't necessarily that I said, well, I really want to play classical mandolin, or I want to play Osso Mio. You know, that all kind of came later.
Meanwhile, the Orpheus Mandolin Orchestra rehearses for Sunday's performance. Oberlin says the soiree will feature a lot of traditional mandolin orchestra music, showing off the instrument at its most beguiling and sprightly.
A lot of gallops, waltzes, marches, stuff that fits pretty well with driving rhythms and a pulse. The mandolin is a pretty up-tempo instrument, you know. It's not a bowed cello, whereas long, drawn-out notes are very effective. Mandolins are quite effective when you're playing quick notes and staccato. But then we also have, as I've mentioned so much, the tremolo, so we have a couple of pieces that are slower with some beautiful tremolo passages with the orchestra. It's a wide range, and especially for people with new ears to the genre of mandolin orchestra, I think they'll love it.
The Orpheus Mandolin Orchestra's Spring Soiree is Sunday at 4 p.m. at the Normal Theater. They'll be joined by guest Brian Oberlin. Admission is free. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Nice!
Brian Oberlin is a busy man making sure the mandolin still has its fans. He's the founder and director of the River of the West Mandolin Group, Great Lakes Mandolin Camp, and the Oregon Mandolin Orchestra. You're listening to the Orpheus Mandolin Orchestra in rehearsal on Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the University of Illinois system. With research, healthcare training, and academic programs, the U of I system's goal is to enrich lives throughout Illinois. Three universities, Urbana-Champaign, Chicago, and Springfield, one system, altogether extraordinary. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Public radio brings you all kinds of opinions, including those you may not share. Hi, I'm News Director Charlie Schlenker. NPR and GLT specialize in breaking down complicated issues and debates. You count on those conversations because you know they help you learn and think twice about your own beliefs. Tough conversations happen on NPR and GLT thanks to the support from people who value honest reporting on diverse perspectives. And the opinion that matters most right now is whether you believe in financially supporting public radio. Contribute at WGLT.org.
Now is the time to make the decision to financially support GLT and NPR. Your first-time contribution will help pay for the credible news and smart entertainment you depend upon. Your contribution will bring us closer to the Fund Drive goal and help keep Fund Drive interruptions to a minimum. You can do all of that with your first-time contribution now at WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The road of a touring musician is littered with the bodies of artists who dealt with long commutes and weird hours in unhealthy ways. It can be a rough way to make a living. Matthew Curry has been on the road, off and on, since he graduated from Bloomington High School over 4 years ago. In this encore interview with GLT's John Norton ahead of his appearance with Edward David Anderson tomorrow night at the BCPA, Curry shares his strategies for dealing with life on the road.
The road of touring is littered with the bodies of musicians and abuse, and it can be a tough way to make a living. How are you working on that? What kind of strategies do you have to make touring work for you and maybe be efficient with your career?
I just try to get sleep when I'm out there. I think that's the most important thing.
Is it something that took a while to learn to do that?
Not necessarily the sleep in its own, but just it took a while to learn in general, the whole touring thing. Like, I remember we hit the road pretty heavy right when I got out of high school.
Which is 4 years ago now.
Yeah. I remember, like, things changed so quick. I was just so used to being a normal person going to school and stuff. And not that I'm not I'm a guitar player. I guess I can't say that I'm normal. But, I remember, like, I was having anxiety attacks and stuff and all this terrible stuff. You know, my chest was locking up. I'm like, oh, geez, what's going on with me? And realized just because everything was changing so rapidly that, you know, my mind was kind of, you know, I was just freaking out a little bit. But I've learned how to cope with that, and I've learned that it's always better to get an extra few hours of sleep than stay up and have those extra few drinks with the guys, you know, so...
So there are strategies that you use, that you've learned to use anyway, what you can and can't do.
I guess, yeah. And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure it affects everybody differently. Yeah, I just try to eat healthy and sleep. You know, nobody's doing the whole sex, drugs, and rock and roll thing. The rock and roll part, sure, but not, you know, nobody's out partying or anything like that, you know.
You sort of realize it's a job, and there's fun along with this job, but it's a job.
Yeah.
I mean, you're out there on the road. I mean, there's a lot of time to yourself out there because you're playing, what, 2 or 3 hours maybe?
At the most.
At the most, and maybe including warm-up and all, you know, sound check and all that?
Yeah.
So the rest of it is out on the road all by yourself or with the guys? And
for the most part, it gets, you know, you start to really find out certain things about people that can bug you when you're stuck in the van with the same four people, you know, so, cracking jokes in the van.
So you're relatively young. So what did you learn after a while that how did you learn how to deal with that?
And this is going to sound silly because it's kind of out of the blue, but one of our big rules, you know, because I'm sure you've done plenty of road trips, you know, is if somebody's got to go, we don't hold it. We stop. And, you know, so that way that if somebody's hungry, we stop. We, you know, we get food. You know, we try to not abuse ourselves, you know, and nobody tries to be heroes and drive for, you know, a million hours at a time or anything like that. But
so even there's a strategy on who's driving and how long.
Yeah.
You trade off, the four of you?
Yeah. Yep, and we're all just waiting for the day when we have a bus and a driver. That sure would be nice.
Lay down. Well, I'm glad you brought your guitar with you. After you play a song for us, right?
Sure.
That's why you brought your guitar. Yeah. I want to ask you about your circle of acquaintances after this and maybe some of the people you've leaned on, other than maybe Steve Miller, who we've talked about in the past, too.
Yeah.
So sure. What's in your box this morning?
This is one I wrote with a good friend of mine, Greg Neville, and it's a song called The Great Midwest.
As the sun hits the horizon and yields the light of the moon, my mind takes me back in time to a lazy afternoon. We're on the banks of the Mackinac, as I threw in the line, almost heard my daddy call, "Son, you get back some time." So troubled times, so many troubled places. I've heard my share of come on lines from lonely empty faces. But no matter where I roam, I long to get back in time.
It goes on into a solo and bridge. And,
love it. Oh, thanks, man. I love that song.
Of course, it's still early for us guitar players. My voice hasn't quite gotten around yet.
As we're recording this, it's about 10 o'clock in the morning. So just, I love that. I love the reference to the Mackinac River.
Oh, thank you, man.
I love the reference to your dad. And it has a Mellencamp sound to it as you're doing acoustic almost, you know?
That was kind of the idea behind it. Obviously, him being from Bloomington,
Indiana. Yeah.
And so we, that was kind of something that actually we were sitting in my basement just throwing the lyrics around and, well, what kind of tune do we put these in? And he actually says to me, he's like, well, what about like kind of a Mellencamp kind of thing? And I was like, well, actually, I've been working on this little riff. So it just kind of fell together in a matter of a couple hours. So that's one of those things. It's a really great feeling to walk away from a songwriting session and with, you know, something that just fell in your lap almost, you know.
Can't wait to hear it plugged in. But I also love the reference, the local references when you bring in the Mackinac. Chicago Farmer does that quite a bit, you know, and I love those local references. You and again, you referenced your dad in this, and I wanted to ask you about this circle of people that you surround yourself with, whether it's musicians or managers or venues, stuff like that, because you don't have your dad. He would have been helping you out probably quite a bit. Who are those people? You've mentioned Steve Miller in the past, someone who's been, is always there for advice. Keeping you straight, keeping you narrow, you know, keeping you focused. Who are some of those other people in your circle?
You know, obviously my family, my mom, my brother, especially, who is my best friend. And him and I spend a lot of time together. And
well, you mentioned in past interviews the two of you have become even closer since you went on the road. And he's your twin brother.
Mm-hmm.
And you continue to become close that way, it sounds like.
Yeah.
What do you give to each other? Because he's in a different place than you are, and you're in a different place than he is. How do you help each other out?
Just talking, you know. Not a ton of kids lost their father when they were 16, and, you know, two brothers who, obviously, you know, boys who wanted to be nothing but their dad. And so, you know, we talk about him a lot, and, you know, I'm really thankful to have him, and I'm sure he feels the same way, and it's one of those things, you know. I've always got his back, and he's always got mine. So no matter what the situation is, and some of my old buddies too. I still, you know, of course we don't see each other as much as we used to with everybody, you know, starting their careers and me being on the road a lot.
Well, you know, that sounds important. It sounds like your brother is the one that really grounds you, and probably your mom as well, but you're hinting at your friends as well that kind of keep you grounded a little bit, too.
Yeah, well, it's always just nice to...
Well, what I'm getting at is Michael Jordan, you know, the superstar he became, he would always go back home to North Carolina, he'd play poker with the guys he grew up with. That sort of kept him grounded. You know, he said that, you know, he'd go back in a smoky room with just the guys smoking cigars and playing poker, and he was just one of the guys. He wasn't Michael Jordan then, you know?
Yeah, and I know for me, and I'm by no way comparing my career in music to his career in basketball, but it is always, excuse me, good to just pretend like you don't tour or make music or, you know, and just be with the buddies for a night and, you know, maybe play poker or me and my friends are real Harley enthusiasts, so we'll all go out riding together and, you know, get lunch somewhere. And so,
well, you want to play something else?
Yeah, I'll play song Luana. It's off the Electric Religion album, and kind of weird story about that. We worked on that album for a long time, Greg and Jeff Paxton and Eric Nelson and I, and had this song that Jeff and I wrote, and we were like, well, we don't really know if this fits with what we have, and so...
It's more of a pop number, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of almost got a bit of a Beatle-y kind of British, I guess, kind of thing to it. So we're like, oh, we'll stick it on the very last of the album, and turned out to be most people's favorite song. So
you just never know, do you?
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah. It's so weird. But we'll give that one a go.
All right.
Matthew Curry in studio with GLT's John Norton late last year. Curry and Edward David Anderson play the BCPA tomorrow night.
With me. In my mind, it seems that I told her I would hold her in my dreams. I saw that guy stopping by. Thought I saw him make you cry just the other day. What did he say to you?
Discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. You can find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Charlie Schlenker and Laura Kennedy. It's also where you can find the full show podcast or individual stories. Find the full show podcast at WGLT.org, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Look so sad, he said.